Well, they could start a little co-op, native co-op. And those that had the fur were the stockholders of that little co-op. That might have happened all along the whole Arctic coast where they had been coming in with the school program for the BIA. When times came, I could see how they were operating when I could understand them more and more. The BIA would bring certain amount of groceries for that native co-op, and they would set the price on the merchandise, saying that they must not make a big profit. And it was hard for those people that were running the co-ops to be able to get enough profit out of the merchandise they were selling to make their business more profitable for the stockholders. And in those days, they had the native boys like Bert Panigiu and some others that helped in the native co-op program as storekeepers. And they used to come to me and say, "Tom, how is it that we can't make much profit here? We could make a better profit if we set our own markup." But the BIA gave us something like 14% to 15% markup. And it was hard for me to understand. After they brought in all their furs and returns for their merchandise, the BIA would take those furs out and put them on the market. And they had themselves a markup of 14% to buy that merchandise for that co-op. And by the time that money was used to try to unload the North Star or like the Boxer or the other ships that came in, and their profit was eaten up before they had anything, and they would reloan them certain amount of money to pay back next year. That continued just in that form for a long, long time, until such time when Irving Ichtinglock came in and they approached me that the co-op does not want to operate the longshoring unloading of the ship for the Barrow co-op. And I told Irving when we were approached, as we were forming a little corporation called the Northern Development. And there, Irving said, "We can't, how is it we're going to make any profit with this kind of a program?" And I said, "Simple enough, if we don't not hire all the people in the village and some extra from Wainwright to come all the way up here to unload that ship, with less people, that we could make a profit." With these in thought, you know, here are corporate structure people that this community had to be dealing with. These are native co-ops with no financing, except in with what the BIA had been handing out to them to pay back with a 14% buying a status for handling it. And I used to just wonder about that. It made it real hard. And those native people suffered from it. They could never get any increase in their stock that I could see myself. Now, to go away from that a little bit, in our community, I have seen with this type of programs, and the village had to have a council, the village council. We had the village council rather than a council with our form of government for the community here. It wasn't established like any other corporate structure, except in as a village council elected by the native people that were living here to work as a council. And we didn't get no pay. We just acted for our community as a village council. In up to 1958, there were others in before me as I was moving with my dad's business. There were others that worked with, after Bert Panigio, to work with the village corporation. But I was in the village council until 1958. And the village had the IRA up to that date. That year, I was asked to write a letter to the Department of Interior to discontinue the IRA that the natives of Barrow were just going to use their village council to operate their community. I was never given acknowledgement. I never received an acknowledgement for that request from the Department of Interior. The reason why I wrote that letter was with Peter Threestar when the land claim settlement was being formed, after it had formed, and we seen this pipeline started to go in from Prudhoe Bay. And the little village of Stevens Village, the natives there, saw that this pipeline was going to go right through the middle of their best hunting ground, their trapping area. And they had an IRA, and they wrote to the Department of Interior for assistance, that they did not want anything done on their land by the pipeline to hurt that area. And the Department of Interior came right about and wrote a letter, apparently, to the Alyeska pipeline people, and they detoured that pipeline from that area around the side of a hill crossing the Yukon River to the right, going south to the right. I read that in the Tundra Times, and Peter Threestar was observing here a lot of times, and he happened to be there when we were to be having a meeting when Joe became the president of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. And I hate to say this, Joe, but you're here, you listen. I think I reminded you of it. The reply came, and Peter Threestar had it, and he showed it to Joe, and it was the acknowledgement that we still had our IRA, that it never was chalked off when I first wrote in 1958. Up till the time we had our land claim, the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation started. Joe took it, and I said to Joe, "Joe, I think I'm still the president of the IRA of Barrow." I would like to chair the meeting and let the people vote for their members, for their IRA, like as prior, the way they have done it. Joe said, no, I'll be the president of the IRA. So I said, okay, Joe, but I cannot release you all of my paperwork to you because you became the president. But if I had chaired that so the people would have known in this community, Joe, I'm saying this to protect what I have to say sometime, because you were not residents actually of this community, and it had to be a resident of Barrow who would have to be the president of the IRA for our community. But being the president up to that period, and the reply came, I thought I would open up the meeting so they would have the IRA properly handed down to whoever it would be. It could have been Joe, it could have been anyone in the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation board members. I wouldn't have cared less, just so it was properly administered. Now, with this, I never released any of my papers to Joe that I had, and I went back home. I was so disgusted with the fact that I destroyed everything so they never would ever pick up any other records that I had under the IRA government of our people here till 1958. But for a period there, they were under the village council, and it was hard, and in those years, I had to be moving out of Barrow. I went into my Reindeer in 1927, again, to come back later in 1948, 49, into the village of Barrow. And when I came in, that's how I became the council member up to the period when I was still the president, 1958. I have heard the qualms and the hurts of a lot of people, but to me it's been something that I could not foresee. I could not foresee what this land claim settlement was going to do to our people. I had worked with my father in our business, and we had established trading posts all along the whole Arctic coast after the whaling industry was over in 19. The last commercial whaling was done in 1919. And in just a couple years, 3-4 years before that period, we had to be thinking to continue our work with H. Liebeson Company as partners into fur. And it was started from Icy Cape, Wainwright, Barrow, Isuk, Beachy Point, Barter Island, Demarcation Point. That's the boundary line. And those had to be serviced. And those ships that we brought in for our whaling venture with Captain Peterson as master at that time, when we severed with Captain Peterson, we had to come in with other captains, and a lot of times I had to be the ice pilot myself, working with them, because I got to know pretty much of the depths along the whole northern section of this Arctic. And I would have to go back to San Francisco and spend winters out in the lower 48 until next year. I've wondered and I've thought, and I've tried to manipulate. Now, the schooling I've had was only up to the fourth grade level. And anything after that was in the school of hard knocks, where I got kicked around and I had to learn it the hard way. And I've had very little schooling, but I was able to take care of my dad's businesses and take care of my own business. Presently, I have my own trading post, the remnant of the Cape Smyth Whaling and Trading, and I have my air taxi. But I can see how our community has been abused in so many ways by white people that came in and would start a small businesses. I don't know how they got their start, but somehow they would get to the poorest of the people in our community and want to buy their house, $300 or $400. That was something that they would jump at. They never realized that this person that bought the house was going to demand the land underneath that house. And that hurt my feeling a lot. And that's how these people, white people, the first ones in the after the 50s, they have acquired number of lots within our community. They got them from the poorest of the people and got those lots. And it kind of hurt my feeling, and I told Eben about it, that we should try and stop the sale of land within the village of Barrow as a councilman. And we allocated with an understanding when we were in the council that whoever goes from Barrow, children, our children, other people's children, from this community, if they went out to school, if they were picked up by military, when they came back, if they want to live, they would be given a parcel of land to build their home on without buying it. It is theirs by inheritance. But our village council started to pick up people that, as I say, there were some white people. And these white people got into the government of our community, and they started controlling this and controlling that. Before too long, most of the native boys themselves got disgusted. They did not argue hard enough. They were too easygoing. Therefore, they lost the control of a lot of what was going on in their own community. And these have been pains in my own self, because I seen them. And now it's something that they're trying to find a way to remedy, and I cannot go out there and tell them what to do, because I'm not in their form of government. We have the present council that has given most of its powers that they had to the borough government. They have only, I think, the recreational status of this community is in the village council. other powers the borough has. There's quite a number of them. Eben was happy when the borough got all those powers. He really was happy. He could play his game then. And I feel it's the younger generation are here fighting as hard as they can to regain what abuse their parents and their people in our community had to suffer. They're going at it, and I think they get overzealous sometimes. They get carried away with what is on their mind. They feel that our government has failed them, the U.S. government has failed them, and that they search remedies for that by looking into the history of how Russia sold Alaska and what boundaries that Russia had given the U.S. for the amount of money that they gave. Well, there's a U.S. flag over all of Alaska up into a certain boundary, and I respect it because it's a federally controlled. And I can't talk back when federal government employees come into our area and start enforcing regulation, fish and game regulations and whatnot, that has to be forced. And I'm stumped at a lot of times, and I just feel I just should take it, let them fight it out the best of their ability. But one of the things that bothered my conscience for a long, long time was that when the War Department came and made a reserve out of PET4, where these communities were all along this whole Arctic coast. Now, why I bring this out is, Dad, when we were forming into the fur business, suggested that we patent our place as a trade and manufacturing site. And it was surveyed, and it was patent 1432, and it's been recorded in the U.S. in Washington, and it's been recorded in through Nome office, it's been in through Fairbanks office, and I have the original of the patent, because I was the third partner when I bought into the firm. And the War Department, through their admirals, sometimes through their generals, I've seen 3- and 4-star stripe ones and admirals and generals come. They wish to see the patent, the original patent, because they have had made a reserve of this section of land using Colville River as the eastern boundary and a certain line on next to Point Lay all the way up to the Colville, and use the Colville River as a boundary. And this patent ground 1342 is one of the only patent ground within the reserve. And we had the residual rights, and here was this piece of land designated by the War Department as a reserve for PET 4. And these admirals and generals would try to talk to me, "Tom, can we take this to Washington?" I says, "No, this patent is going to stay right in the safe. I have copies made. You can have the copies." But they've used Max Brewer, they've used John Sindler, to try to talk me to give them that patent so they could lay their hands on it. I'm pretty sure they would have destroyed it, so I would have no proof of the patent. But that patent, I have the original, and it's in the safe. But when they come and I get approached by these admirals, I would have to say, why did you make a reserve knowing that this patent ground was established in Barrow and left me with just an opening out to sea and I'm surrounded by a reserve? I says, you have no right whatsoever in your laws where you're supposed to take a patent ground, a man's land, and surround it so he would have no way to expand. The only way he'd have to come out would be out to sea. That I could probably have some oil company drill a hole right on that patent ground. And if there happens to be natural gas, I could apply to the community to feed that and give it fuel from natural gas. And they would say to me, Tom, for Christ's sake, don't do that. And this was something to kind of tease them a little. I wasn't going to do it, but I just bring it out just to them to see just how far they would go if I tried it. Now, I'm just saying this because it is something for me that had very little schooling to be able to see that there was some value in that patent ground, and when time arises, that it could be beneficial for some type of an understanding for my people. It could be brought out why these communities like Barrow, Wainwright, Nuvok, Halkett, Point Lay can be surrounded within that patent reserve, PETFOR reserve. That's what has bothered my conscience. And I think my people have not truthfully understood that area, why our federal government made a PETFOR reserve without approaching the people that had lived along this whole Arctic coast for hundreds and hundreds of years. Their land. And that's why I'm bringing it out tonight. And I have an allotment here within this patent ground because I had leased a 99-year lease when I was with my reindeer for 1.25 acres using Chip River as my western boundary. My eastern line was at a longitude 180, all the way up into the Colville River from the Arctic coast, this portion of the Arctic coast, from the bottom of Teas Inlet, including Cape Simpson, Smith Bay, all the way towards where Lonely is, this place called Pitt Point. That's where the military base Lonely is established right now. That was one of the new line, I think it was a B station or something. A station, I think, it could have been POW 1. I think it's POW 1. Because I think at Simpson was an A station. And then the POW 1, and A, B was in the bottom of Harrison Bay, and then Ulictuk is POW 2. I'm pretty sure I think that's the way it is. But I was given a number for my allotment, but it has an IF stipulation on it. Being within this patent reserve, I would have to forfeit if there was any oil, natural gas, on that for my allotment. The reason why I wanted my allotment, because I had the 99-year lease, when I had my reindeer for close to 30 years, I had my homes built, I had my corrals, I had my underground coal storages, where Charlie Edwardson and some of his brother and some of my other younger brothers, Arnold and Robert, worked with me. We had established that herd and used it for our own family operation. And when the BIA again later created the co-op program for the natives from the mouth of the Yukon all the way up to the Canadian border, they took away the owners of those herds and put people that never herded control of all those herds, and in less than 5 years, pretty near all the reindeer, which were over a million, from the mouth of the Yukon to the Canadian border, were lost. I was the only one that did not join with my family herd, and that herd was the only one left until 1951. The others had been gone. The wolves had used them up because they used poor management, and I had a verbal agreement with the War Department during their operation that they will not buzz with their aircraft the herds to stampede them, especially during calving time. But in 1951, I had to come on in 49, and 51 was the year our herd was lost. My three boys, my three sons were single, and they were taking care of the herd. And I had this verbal agreement, but there were, at that particular year, in 1951, the last seismic crews for the PET-4 started their operation from Cape Simpson, right there where my summer grazing is, and it's a long peninsula, and I had those three boys drive that herd down to that peninsula to come in so they could take back their supplies to the home base. And in just a week and a half, those college men, using weasels as means of transportation, stampeded the whole herd to the south of our home site, and it got into the paths of the migration caribou and crossed over to the western boundary we had. And here we had over 3,000 head in that herd that year. And I tried to make arrangement with the native with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, who was Williams, his name was Williams, that I would give them for a restart of what they had lost of approximately 800 to 900 fawns that were born that spring for our increase, if they would allow us to pick up our own deer which happened to cross over to the old Barrow herding grounds. And he says, no. He says, you have made us look pretty small all these years. Individual that did not join the co-op program, and when your herd was left, all the others that joined the co-op program under the BIA were lost. You made us to look silly. We're not going to allow you. And I said to my wife, I have to strap my guns, and I think this is where range war will have to start for reindeer. My wife was the only one, she was here tonight, that talked me out. She says, Tom, there'll be a lot of dead people. You're too fast with the gun when you were young. And she says, I would rather you lose everything in the reindeer rather to hurt somebody. I had to take that with biting my lips, and because I was a man that never shirked anything that I had to be doing, and here was my wife telling me to let it go. Here I had roughly, for my family and my nephews, approximately $200,000 worth of cattle in the value of approximately $25 each, which was the going price at that time to sell our reindeer. When I wish later to buy a few reindeer from Andrew Skin, from Sealewing, the BIA came and told him, if Tom wants to buy your reindeer to restart, charge him not less than $200 to $250 a head. So there you are. That's how a lot of things like this, for my own conscience, I wonder a lot of times, and makes me wonder just what I should do, what I should say. Sometimes I get discouraged a bit, but I hope the young people in our community, the native boy, have gumption enough to fight. And if I have to, I say, come and ask assistance in any way I can be assistance to you, I'll help you. So that is my testimony regarding of what the buildup of what has been going on with your hearings lately, that more recent things that I have tried not to be part of after I had gotten into my own business. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Brower, for that fascinating glimpse into the history of the Arctic Slope. The way things are going in Barrow, we'll have to stay another 3 days just to... let's go ahead now then, Mr. Uppickson.
Thank you, Justice Berger. It's the third time I'm appearing before you. And there is going to be a point of clarification where I can say that I am not gross in usurping authorities, but as it has been explained to me, the Howard Wheeler Act, or the Indian Reorganization Act, clearly says that you cannot belong to two IRA corporations. Now, the program was that Arctic Slope Native Association was to make the presentation on what we relate to now as the regional IRA, which would put all of our villages under that one IRA. Now, this being the program of ASNA, it was entirely different from what Mr. Brower had alluded to. My father wouldn't allow me to conduct myself and show disrespect to my elders. The first two testimonies I made before you, the first one was what the Arctic Slope Native Association did. Then the following day, since there were references made to Arctic Slope Native Association saying no to the President of the United States in signing the ANGSA, we had to tell you why. Now, getting to the history and the leaders that were behind the Arctic Slope Native Association leadership, I might say, Justice Berger, that Tom Brower Sr. was the one that nominated me for the first vice president of ASNA, and I in return nominated him for that position. But as it came out, I beat him by not a landslide, but I just beat him. This was my first exposure with the Arctic Slope Native Association leadership. Now, the people that were involved in causing Arctic Slope Native Association to be were people like Charlie Edwardson Jr., the Reverend Samuel Simmons, who is now the minister at Wainwright, and the late Guy Ukakuk, who had been the correspondent for Fairbanks Daily News Miner. These were the three signatories that caused Arctic Slope Native Association to be. The purpose of Arctic Slope Native Association was, first of all, to protect the Aboriginal lands that we claim in the Arctic, which, as you have heard, the boundaries described as the watershed of the Brooks Range along the Geelong Mountains to the coast of the Chukchi Sea, the Beaufort Sea, and on to the demarcation line. And totally amount of 56.5 million acres. Secondly, we were to promote and protect the culture and lifestyle that our Inupiat people had in the Arctic. And thirdly, was to seek quality education for our Inupiat children and students. The funding for the Arctic Slope Native Association, when I became the president in '69, came from the Mother's Club activities, their fundraising activities. It came from the bingo games of the communities. It came from the bingo games of veterans of foreign war. And it came from the members who donated monies to Arctic Slope Native Association, and including those people that supported our cause. I would like to relate to one time where the Arctic Slope Native Association was sending a delegate or delegates to Juneau to meet with Alaska Federation of Natives and the attorney, the United States Attorney General Ramsey Clark. Arctic Slope Native Association didn't have enough money to buy a ticket for me. So Forrest Solomon Sr. took out his credit card and gave it to the Ween agent, Ween ticket agent, and said, "Here, use my credit card." This was the type of faith that the members of the Arctic Slope Native Association had towards our aims and goals. The membership of the Arctic Slope Native Association were those of Inupiat blood in the Arctic Slope. What we had to do to continue our lobbying effort of the Alaska Native Land Claims was